Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start off with a series of articles from Bloomberg Business News, the April 1st edition. The first article is entitled, In Context, A New Way to Think About the World, The New Battleship Diplomacy. It's by Kevin Crowley and Ruth Lau. Ripping up old alliances and turning the post-World War II axis on its head would have been impossible for any previous American president because of the U.S.'s insatiable thirst for imported energy. But the Trump White House is able to lean on an increasingly critical Made in America commodity to exert new levels of geopolitical leverage. Liquefied natural gas. In the span of about 7 years, the U.S. transformed itself from an irrelevant supplier of liquid natural gas into the world's largest. Now it's set to expand its production capacity by a further 60% before the end of Donald Trump's presidency, according to an estimate from Bloomberg NEF. By the end of the decade, almost one in every three tankers carrying the super-chilled fuel will originate in the United States, giving Trump his best chance to attain the energy dominance his campaign promised. No matter what Trump does to alienate the U.S. from its allies, his unorthodox moves aren't hurting demand for American-made natural gas. In the first weeks of his second term, he sought to broker a peace deal for Ukraine without key allies or Ukraine, slapped tariffs on trade partners, and pitched an outrageous idea to remake the Middle East. Leaders from Europe, India, and Japan have responded with pledges to buy more American gas. It's mind-blowing to think that the President of the United States doesn't have to worry about imported energy when negotiating for peace in the Middle East or on the European continent, says Amy Myers Jaffe, a professor at New York University who teaches about energy and climate finance. You can lead those discussions from a position of power. Trump frequently talks of his plans to ramp up America's production of liquid gold, the fracked oil he accused President Joe Biden of holding back, out of concern about climate change. But U.S. crude production will grow only about 2.9% this year, as the shale industry waits to tap future drilling locations. The Permian, the country's biggest oil basin, could reach peak production as soon as 2028, the last full year of Trump's presidency, before plateauing, according to S&P Global. Likewise, Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent's pledge to increase oil production by 3 million barrels a day as part of his 3-3-3 plan to boost the economy, which also includes getting the fiscal deficit down to 3% of gross domestic product and sustaining growth at 3%, is likely to be achieved only if measured in barrels of so-called oil equivalent, which includes gas, says Raoul LeBlanc, an analyst at S&P Global. Oil is probably not going to grow meaningfully in the short run, Energy Secretary Chris Wright said in an interview with Bloomberg Television in February. U.S. gas production, on the other hand, is going to grow dramatically in the next 2 or 3 years, he said. Or, as Vice President J.D. Vance put it while on the campaign trail in Pennsylvania, we're sitting on the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. We've just got to unleash that. 20 years ago, the idea that natural gas would play an even more important role than crude oil in U.S. diplomatic calculations would have been preposterous. At the turn of the millennium, the U.S. was short of gas. It generated less than 15% of the country's power, outflanked by nuclear and coal. Horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which picked up in the early aughts, changed all of that. The two techniques unlocked previously inaccessible oil and gas reserves, from North Dakota to New Mexico. The U.S. more than doubled its natural gas production to more than 100 billion cubic feet per day, and it now fuels 41% of the country's electricity. In fact, shale gas supplies rose so quickly during the past 20 years that they far outpaced domestic demand, prompting a decade-long malaise in prices that hurt producer profits. the industry looked for more ways to deploy its gas, including by building plastics-making petrochemical plants along the Gulf Coast. But the holy grail is to export it, especially because international customers are willing to pay higher prices. Europe needs a long-term replacement for Russian supplies. Asia needs fuel for its fast-growing economies. And the developed world needs more energy to satisfy the demand from data centers powering artificial intelligence. An expanding number of companies, including Cheniere Energy Incorporated and Venture Global Incorporated, have raced to build multi-billion dollar liquefaction facilities to help them serve the overseas market. The complex plants can chill natural gas to 256 degrees Fahrenheit, transforming it into a liquid state that specialized ships then transport overseas, where it's regasified. 8 of these sites are already operating in the United States, with 3 more under construction, and the owners of several others close to deciding whether to move forward with final investment. Trump is also trying to breathe life into a long-stalled LNG project in Alaska. Although no friend of the oil and gas industry, Biden advanced the LNG agenda set in Trump's first term after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. U.S. supplies to Europe could replace the gas for the continent piped in from Russia, helping to deprive President Vladimir Putin's war machine, he said. The Netherlands, France, and the U.K. quickly became the biggest buyers of America LNG. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen praised Biden for being a reliable partner and said the transatlantic relationship was stronger and more united than ever. Once seen as a transition fuel to help wean the world off coal as it moves toward clean renewables, natural gas has surprisingly endured. That could have dire consequences for combating climate change, which will require reductions in all fossil fuel, including natural gas, if the world is to reach its net zero emissions by 2050. All the talk was that natural gas was a bridge fuel, says Mike Summers, chief executive officer of the American petroleum industry, which lobbies for the oil and gas industry. It's clear now that natural gas is the future fuel. U.S. natural gas prices have averaged $3.55 per million British thermal units over the past 5 years, about 70% lower than the European average, providing the economy with a major competitive advantage and helping to underpin both Biden's and Trump's policies to bring U.S. manufacturing back from overseas. Energy is the foundation for every economy, so the fact that the U.S. can supply itself cheaply and increasingly export to the rest of the world is a huge advantage, says Arjun Murthy, a partner at Veriten LLC, a Houston-based energy research and advisory firm. The U.S. gas industry's meteoric growth hit a roadblock in the final year of Biden's presidency, when his administration put a moratorium on new LNG export licenses while it scrutinized the effect on climate change. Trump lifted the pause on his first day in the office, with no mention of the climate concerns that prompted Biden to halt approvals. The country's expansion in gas production and exports stands in stark contrast to the state of the U.S. oil industry. Although it's the world's largest, it doesn't provide Trump with the geopolitical heft enjoyed by OPEC and its de facto leader, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman. America currently pumps about 13.5 million barrels a day, about 50% more than Saudi Arabia. But growth prospects are limited. Low oil prices force producers to reduce costs and preserve what's left of their runway of future drilling locations. But if America's natural gas industry continues to expand as expected, this slow growth may not matter. Europe, for now dependent on the U.S. for gas, has little room to maneuver. Even as Ukraine fumes over Trump's apparent sympathy for Putin, its largest private energy company is in talks with U.S. sellers over a 2-year LNG supply contract. Under threat from major U.S. tariff hikes, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi pledged to facilitate imports. Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan are considering purchasing more American LNG to head off Trump's tariffs and reduce their trade surplus with the world's biggest economy. The president's strategy also carries the danger of pushing away some key buyers. China, last year's biggest LNG importer, in February slapped retaliatory tariffs on American gas in response to additional U.S. tariffs. And that's not the only risk. With so many new U.S. plants coming online, analysts expect the market to be oversupplied by the end of the decade, which could cause prices to drop. Even so, LNG is typically more expensive than coal and not as clean as renewables. And China has shown both of these other fuel sources can often be produced domestically without having to rely on imports. No government wants to be dependent on import markets unless they have no choice, says Myers Jaffe, the New York University professor. For the next 2 years or so, countries may have no choice, she says. But we're at such a transformative period for energy. 10 years from now, there will be a choice. The window for U.S. natural gas is not infinite. Have you ever gone to a car dealership and suffered through buying a new car? I think we all have at one time or another. But the next article says that there may be another way to buy a car in the future, and the traditional dealerships are not necessarily thrilled with the idea. Here's an article by Keith Naughton. It's from Bloomberg Businessweek. It's entitled, Dealerships Fight Their Disruption. When second-generation car dealer Mark White learned a new Volkswagen AG electric vehicle line was set to be produced in his home state of South Carolina, he hoped to be among the very first to start selling the cars. He approached the company, offering to build a $10 million showroom on the prime piece of local property at his own expense to showcase the models, and was turned down flat. That's when White discovered VW plans to cut out the middleman, like him, and sell its Scout Motors pickups and SUVs directly to consumers when they go on sale in 2027. They obviously feel like they can do it better, or maybe less expensively, says White, 45. His family's been selling VW automobiles for more than 60 years, starting with Mark's late father, Steve, under whose name the dealership still operates. His teenage son, who only just got his driver's license, is eager to sell cars there someday too. So White is fighting back, testifying to the state legislature that allowing the direct-to-consumer sales could put the livelihoods of his 150 employees at risk. For about as long as U.S. drivers have been buying cars, they've been doing it through dealers who distribute vehicles and allow in-person customers to do trade-ins, to access financing, and to negotiate prices. But they also eat into carmakers' profits, and some manufacturers are anxious to break free. Among the first cars to sell directly to the consumer were the then upstart EV companies such as Tesla Incorporated, which famously built its own showrooms instead of establishing a dealer network. As a quick aside from the article, I bought a Tesla in 2020 in Scottsdale at the Tesla dealership at the Fashion Square Kierland Mall. The entire process took 10 minutes. It was the simplest car purchase experience I've ever had, and much less painful than the standard 2 or 3 hours that it takes. Okay, enough said. Back to the article. Now, legacy automakers, including VW and Honda Motor Company, are taking their first stab at direct sales with new EV brands like VW's Scout line. If successful, they could upend the new car market in the United States and the long-entrenched dealership industry, which Cox Automotive Incorporated estimates sold $627 billion worth of new vehicles to buyers in 2024. But automakers trying to sell straight to drivers face fierce resistance from dealers who tend to be well-financed, politically connected, and protected by a thicket of state franchise laws that preserve their way of doing business. Dealers don't want direct sales to happen because they have no interest in letting that dam break, said Alexander Edwards, president of San Diego-based Strategic Vision. which surveys consumers and consults with automakers. They want to keep their money flowing. In South Carolina, direct-to-consumer auto sales aren't actually legal, and an effort by the state legislature to change that has stalled following opposition from dealers. Dealerships in California and Florida have also taken legal action to block VW from pursuing direct sales of the new brand. For now, Scout's reservation process looks much like that of any other consumer product. Car buyers can go online, select either its sport utility vehicle or truck, choose between an all-electric or a range-extending plug-in hybrid model, then fill in their credit card information and put down $100 in a refundable deposit. But that only gives the consumer a place in line, because the actual purchase won't be completed until Scout models go on sale in 2 years. It should be that you can buy a vehicle in minutes on your sofa, says Cody Thacker, Scout's vice president for commercial operations. It all should be as easy as buying a T-shirt on Amazon. Buyers in California can also reserve online the new EV that Honda developed through a joint venture with electronics giant Sony Group Corporation ahead of its launch next year. Chief Executive Officer of the JV, Shugo Yamaguchi, described the purchase process as a breeze without any hassle. In remarks at a January trade show, dealers usually make a percentage from each of the vehicles sold, and top-end models tend to draw prospective buyers into showrooms, so the decision to sell directly to consumers hurts even more on a pricey model. Sony Honda Mobility's Afeela 1 signature EV starts at $102,900. Honda should understand that any misguided attempt to bypass or undercut its U.S. dealers will be challenged in state houses and courthouses across the country, Mike Stanton, president of the National Automobile Dealers Association, said in a statement. Dave Robinson, an executive at auto researcher Edmunds-Com Incorporated in Spokane, Washington, bought a Tesla Cybertruck last summer and relished the ease of the process. I like not having to spend half my Saturday in a dealership and feeling like the salespeople were talking to the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain while I'm waiting in the finance office, the 44-year-old said. Never again am I going to set foot in a dealership. Of course, not everyone wants to buy a car without a visit to the dealership. Before a major outlay, many shoppers want to kick the tires and take test drives, which is why Scout is planning to open 25 locations in 16 major markets when it premieres in 2 years. But don't call them dealerships. Some will be showrooms and malls, as Tesla has opened, while others will be standalone Scout workshops with show floors up front and service bays in the back. Scout workshops will look a little like a dealership, but customers will finish the transaction online. Although these kinds of changes require some investment, they also eliminate the cost of franchise dealers, allowing for greater profits. Tesla's direct sales let it earn an extra $2,000 to $4,000 per automobile, car industry executives have estimated. Dealers, for their part, have been trying to make the business process less painful by digitizing parts of it, including allowing for price negotiation via text or online chat. Still, car salespeople consistently rank among the bottom of America's most trusted occupations, alongside lobbyists and members of Congress. Car dealers are not all bad. We do bring some value to the table, says White, the South Carolina dealer. Scout and Sony Honda have tried to get around franchise laws requiring automakers to sell through their dealers by establishing themselves as independent entities within their parent companies. Scout doesn't fall under Volkswagen Group of America, the arm that contracts with U.S. dealerships. It's positioned instead beneath a wider Volkswagen umbrella company, so it could be treated like any other of its hundreds of legal entities, which include the luxury Porsche and the Lamborghini brands. You don't see Volkswagen dealers selling Porsches or Porsche dealers selling Lamborghinis, says Scott Thacker. Dealers don't have an unassailable right to another brand and another model of vehicle. That's not how VW and Audi dealers in Florida see it. They sued Scout in February to prevent the brand from selling directly to consumers in their state. Florida car dealers had their legislature update the state's automotive franchise laws in 2023 to prevent this very thing. The new law says that if any auto manufacturer owns or controls more than 30% of an entity, it's required to sell through franchise dealers. Scout is wholly owned by Volkswagen. Meanwhile, drivers report they're increasingly open to purchasing online. Still, only about 5% actually click buy, a January survey from Cox found. That might be because of limited buying options to date, or because a car is more of a big-ticket purchase that consumers make only occasionally, so they don't mind taking it a little more slowly. People say that they want to buy a car with one click, said Aaron Keating, a senior director of economic and industry insights at Cox. But the minute they get into monthly payments of $500 or more, and you're spending $50,000 on something, the quicker you see them saying, I might actually want to talk to somebody. I warn everybody now, if you're a jealous person, you may not want to listen to this next article. It's about some seriously high salaries, and as some of you may have guessed, yes, the people making these salaries are athletes, in this case, baseball players. The title of the article is Baseball's Highest Paid Players in 2025. It's by Justin Birnbaum, and it's from the March 30th edition of Fortune Daily magazine. Major League Baseball's top earners will haul in $576 million combined this season, led by the sport's first $200 million men, in Mets signing Juan Soto and Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani. The NFL may be the world's most lucrative sports league, but Major League Baseball will beat it to one milestone this year, a player making at least $100 million in one season. In fact, Major League Baseball will do it twice. New York Mets right fielder Juan Soto is baseball's highest paid player, due to collect an estimated $126.9 million in 2025 before taxes and agents fee. And Los Angeles Dodgers two-way phenom Shohei Ohtani will join him in the nine-figure club with an estimated $102 million. Previously, Major League Baseball's top earnings figure was Ohtani's $65 million in 2023. No football player, meanwhile, has exceeded Dallas Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott's 2024 total of $96.3 million in a single league year. The two stars reached their landmark paydays by traveling two very different paths. Soto, the most coveted free agent of this offseason, joined the Mets on a 15-year, $765 million contract, which could rise in value to $805 million if the team chooses to exercise a clause to void an opt-out and keep him in Queens. The 26-year-old slugger will add to his $46.9 million salary for 2025 with a $75 million signing bonus. He then tacks on another $5 million from endorsements. For Ohtani, the split is almost the exact opposite. When he signed a 10-year, $700 million contract with the Dodgers before last season, he deferred 97% of the value until 2034 and beyond, leaving him just a $2 million salary each year up to that point. But he will haul in an estimated $100 million off the field this year, thanks to one of the most lucrative sponsor portfolios in sports history. While new Dodgers signing Blake Snell, also beating Ohtani's previous Major League Baseball earnings mark by totaling an estimated $65.6 million this season, baseball's 10 highest players are set to be paid $506 million combined in 2025, an astonishing 25% increase from 2024's record of $462 million. Still, Soto and Ohtani are rightfully drawing most of the attention. Only 8 other team sports athletes have crossed the 100 million threshold in a single season. The NBA's LeBron James, Steph Curry, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and soccer stars Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, Neymar Jr., Kylian Mbappe, and Karim Benzema. These milestones feel like a lot of records, says David M. Carter, a sports business consultant and adjunct professor of management and organization at USC. They're meant to be broken, and in ways we have yet to fully contemplate, given how rapidly content is changing, being distributed, and monetized. Ohtani is an even more rarefied heir, as one of only 4 active athletes ever to have hit $100 million off the field in 12 months, along with Conor McGregor, who made $158 million in 2021 after selling his whiskey brand, Proper No. 12, Tiger Woods, $105 million in 2009, and Roger Federer, $100 million in 2020. It's even more impressive considering how baseball has lagged behind other major sports with its marketing opportunities. With MLB's rigorous schedule and an aging and hyper-regionalized fan base, often leaving endorsement deals in short supply. Outside of Ohtani, who earned an estimated $60 million last year from his business ventures, New York Yankees outfielder Aaron Judge and Philadelphia Phillies first baseman Bryce Harper lead the way off the field with an estimated $8 million apiece. Excluding equity payouts, no other player has come close to touching the $9 million that Derek Jeter was pulling in when he retired in 2014. But Ohtani, who is sponsored by more than 20 companies, including New Balance, Beats by Dre, Fanatics in the U.S., and Kose Skincare, Kauer Pharmaceuticals, and Seiko Watches across the Pacific, is now working with a different kind of math, thanks to the baseball-obsessed Japanese market. His adoring fans there watch his games in numbers that can exceed even the American viewership, and his image is plastered on billboards and products around the country in a way that has no direct parallel to an athlete in the United States. Folks, we're going to take just a moment now to do a quick station break. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Okay, let's go back to some major salary news. Desuki Segura, a co-founder of Japanese-focused sports agency Gifted Existence Management, notes that many Japanese companies are trying to expand outside their home market. And right now, Ohtani is the big ticket to becoming a global company. That has led many prospective partners to meet the superstar's exorbitant rates. And given that many of the country's CEOs are baseball fans, there may be an element of gaining access to Ohtani, too. I think he's probably harder to meet than the president, adds Segura, who watched the Dodgers beat the Chicago Cubs in a Tokyo Dome sellout last week to open the 2025 regular season. Ohtani, who led the total earnings ranking in each of the last 2 years, may face another challenge for number one in 2026. From Toronto Blue Jays first baseman Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who's due to test free agency in the offseason. But he shouldn't have to worry about Soto, whose massive signing bonus, along with Snell's $52 million bonus, is a one-time payout that'll be coming off the books. When it comes to baseball players' income, Ohtani is just in a different ballpark. Now, here are the top 5 earners in Major League Baseball. Number 1, Juan Soto, $121.9 million on-field, off-field, $5 million. Shohei Ohtani, $2 million on-field, $100 million off-field. Blake Snell, $64.8 million on-field, 8-tenths of a million off-field. Aaron Judge, $48 million on-field, off-field, $8 million. And finally, Zach Wheeler, $42.2 million on-field, $200,000 off-field. Over the past few weeks, we've done occasional articles on the fact that gold price continues to go up. Now remember, gold has been considered for a very long time as a store of value. Here's an article from Fortune magazine. It's by Jason Scott and Yvonne Yu Lee. It's entitled, Gold Rises Above $3,100 for the First Time as U.S. Levies Boost Havens. Bullion gained as much as 1.4% to $3,127 an ounce. Prices have posted four straight weekly gains, supported by growing haven demand amid a risk-off mood for broader markets. Traders are on edge as Trump plans on Wednesday, and that is April 2nd, so that Wednesday will have passed by the time you hear this article. You will be listening to it on Monday. The Wednesday they're talking about was the previous Wednesday. To announce sweeping levies on all America's trading partners. Last week, the U.S. leaders signed a proclamation to implement a 25% tariff on auto imports. Physical demand and favorable macro backdrop are helping to drive gold's rally, according to Amy Gower, commodity strategist at Morgan Stanley. Recent investors buying bars, coins, and exchange-traded funds represent a new inflow to gold coming through here, and arguably plenty more to go here, said Gower during an interview with Bloomberg TV. And then there's the macro angle to gold of how does it compete with an investor's portfolio against rates and equities and bonds. Bullion is often the go-to haven in times of economic and political uncertainty. Investors' holdings of physically backed gold ETFs have climbed 6% so far in 2025, after 4 years of net outflows, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Gold is up almost 19% this year, in a run that's seen its clinch at least 15 all-time highs. The rally's been fueled by central bank buying and haven demand amid rising geopolitical and micro uncertainties. Those drivers have supported prices, even as swaps traders have paired bets on Federal Reserve easing this year to 2/4-point rate cuts. Lower rates tend to benefit non-yielding bullion. Gower expects gold to rise further to the $3,300 to $3,400 level this year, joining several major banks which have raised their price targets for the precious metal. Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated this month ramped up its forecast to $3,300 an ounce by year-end. The lenders cited higher-than-expected central bank demand and strong inflows into bullion-backed exchange-traded funds. Spot gold was trading at $3,113.72 an ounce as of 10:32 in New York, and this is on March 31st. The Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index was little changed. Silver dropped, while platinum and palladium both gained. All of you have probably heard of Elon Musk. I'd be shocked if you haven't. And all of you have probably heard of SpaceX, his rocket company. But many of you have probably never heard the name of the woman who actually runs the company. This is an article from Fortune magazine. And the title of the article is Gwen Shotwell Rides SpaceX to $1 Billion Fortune. It's by Jeremy Bogaisky. With Elon Musk's attention divided among his many companies, Shotwell has been the constant presence ensuring that the rocket maker delivers on its ambition plans. She's profiting handsomely, Forbes reveals. Tesla's share price may be cratering as billionaire CEO Elon Musk pursues his side hustle of chainsawing the federal workforce, but investors still believe in his rocket company, SpaceX. That's made Gwen Shotwell a billionaire. Musk's longtime lieutenant at SpaceX holds a 0.3% stake in the company, Forbes estimates, based on accounts of her stock compensation from investors and early employees. That stake is worth $1.2 billion after the private company's valuation hit $350 billion in December in a sale of insider shares. Shotwell declined to comment on Forbes' estimate. For Shotwell, 61, it's a rich reward for the gamble she took when she joined SpaceX in 2002 as employee number 11, tasked with leading sales of Musk's as-yet-unbuilt rocket. At the time, the Northwestern-trained mechanical engineer was going through a divorce with two young children to care for, and she hesitated to leave a safe position at a small rocket maker. But Musk had pumped $100 million into SpaceX from his proceeds from the sales of PayPal, and after thinking about it for over a month, Shotwell bought into his vision of creating reusable rockets that could offer low-cost access to space. I called him on the phone and said, "I'm a bleeping idiot," Shotwell recounted in a talk at Stanford University in 2022, and he laughed and said, "Welcome to the team." In 2008, Musk promoted her to running the team as president and chief operating officer. With Musk's attention split between Tesla and his other ventures, she's kept the ambitious space company delivering on a breakneck development schedule and helped make it the dominant rocket company on Earth. SpaceX has scaled from 8 launches of its Falcon rocket in 2016 to a staggering 134 in 2024. The next closest, China's state-owned CASC, managed just 48. SpaceX carried 83% of all satellites put into orbit worldwide last year, according to a report from the consultancy Bryce Tech. Most of those were SpaceX's own communication satellite, which are the main reason investors are excited about the company. SpaceX has built up a constellation of 6,800 satellites in low Earth orbit that, as of year end, were providing broadband internet service to 4.6 million subscribers, up 90% from 2023. SpaceX doesn't share financials, but in November, Shotwell said Starlink was going to turn a profit for the year. "The company is incredibly valuable, I think, right now because of Starlink," she said at the Barron Investment Conference. "Starlink will add a zero, probably. At least we continue to grow the Starlink system." Morgan Stanley estimates that Starlink achieves an operating profit of $900 million in 2024 on 9.3 percent billion in revenue. But any cash from operations was likely canceled out by high spending to build out the Starlink constellation and develop SpaceX's giant Starship rocket. With roughly 4 times the payload capacity of Falcon 9, Starship is the linchpin in SpaceX's plans to dramatically increase the Starlink constellation's coverage and performance, and realizes Musk's vision of reaching Mars, not to mention boosting SpaceX's value even more. "Ultimately, I think Starship will be the thing that takes us over the top as one of the most valuable companies," Shotwell said at a Barron conference. "We can't even envision what Starship is going to do to humanity and humans' lives, and I think that will be the most valuable part of SpaceX." Last week, we did an article on the incredibly competitive streaming services market, Apple versus Netflix. Now we're going to do an article on exactly how the consumer feels about cable versus streaming services. This is by Chris Morris. It's from March 31st edition of Fortune magazine. The title of the article is "Cable Cord Cutters Are Returning as Streaming Services Prices Increase," study says. Cord cutting and cable could be turning around. A growing number of people who'd abandoned cable subscriptions are changing their mind. Costs and reliability are two of the most cited reasons. Roughly 15 years ago, a movement began to take shape as people got fed up with the ever-escalating costs of their cable subscriptions. Cord cutters began to drop their subscriptions to Comcast, Time Warner, and more. But, as many things do, that trend is starting to reverse itself. As the cost of cable alternatives begins to hit new heights, and streaming services move from a customer acquisition model to a profit-focused one, a growing number of people are rethinking their divorce from cable operators. A new study from Coupon Cabin finds 22% of the people who cut the cord have changed their minds and returned to a cable subscription. Another 6% are considering making the switch in the near term. Cost isn't the only reason for the second guessing. Cable service isn't reliant on internet connection, meaning it can be more reliable and isn't subject to slowdowns that impact picture quality. It's also a reliable way to watch live sports, which has become a key differentiator for broadcasters, and one which streaming services are quickly trying to buy the rights for. In 2013, the study reports, some 81% of U.S. homes had a cable subscription. Today, that number is down to 37%. A lot of that cord cutting took place during the pandemic. An estimated 6.6 million households dropped their cable subscriptions in 2020. Cord cutting hasn't had as harsh an impact on cable TV providers as some expected, though. That's because most cable giants are also among the top provider of broadband home internet service. Growth rates for that service has begun to slow as well. Now, for those of you whose income consists largely of tips, here's an article from Fortune magazine dated March 31st. It's by Alicia Adamczyk. Title of the article is, Trump has promised no taxes on tips and Social Security, but you still need to pay them this year. And by the way, so far as tips are concerned, both Uber and DoorDash are pressing Republican lawmakers to get President Trump's no tax on tips to apply to Uber and DoorDash drivers. President Donald Trump's pledges to end taxes on tips and Social Security payments have caught the attention of workers across the country. But even if those policies do eventually become law, financial planners are reminding taxpayers that any changes won't affect the returns that they must file by April 15th of this year. While the president endorsed ending taxes on Social Security benefits, tips, and overtime wages during his campaign, as of now, the old rules apply. For tax year 2024, the taxes currently being filed, all cash and non-cash tips are subject to federal taxes, and Social Security is still being taxed. Taxpayers should be mindful that a proposal by the president does not mean that legislation will be passed accordingly, and to plan according to what is known, not what may happen, says Tippi Walker, a certified financial planner at Lucre Advisory. The upshot is that taxpayers should be careful about getting their hopes up. Legislation regarding no taxes on Social Security benefits, for example, has been proposed and failed multiple times, says Walker. The reasons are varied, but two big ones are that, assuming everything else stays the same, it would accelerate the insolvency of the program while also increasing the budget deficit significantly. Those are reasons why some economists don't support that policy. When it comes to eliminating taxes on overtime, some economists worry that regular tipped workers wouldn't be the ones to benefit the most. Instead, they say, it's likely that high earners and employers will use the policy to game the system. But it could happen at the state level. Lawmakers in at least 19 states have introduced bills to exempt overtime pay from state taxes this year. Similarly, economists say not taxing tips sounds better in theory than it would be for workers in the long run. While it could help boost take-home pay for employers in the service industry in the short run, in the long run, they would lose out on Social Security and Medicare benefits. For now, employees who receive tips still need to keep their daily records and report the tips to their employers, say financial planners. It's still possible that the policies could see action later this year on the federal level. Congress approved a budget blueprint in February that'll help guide future legislation, which leaves the door open for them. But the House and Senate currently need to work out a bill together that can pass with a Republican slim majority. With so many other competing tax and budget priorities, it is unclear what policies will eventually be included in it. Now let's talk fraud, and it's always kind of fun talking about fraud. Here's an article from Fortune magazine by Megan Poinsky. It's entitled, Inside the AI Arms Race Between Fraudsters and Visa. For Visa and rival MasterCard, fighting the explosion of fraud attempts is both a big expense and an opportunity for profit. Visa's Cyber Fusion Center in Ashburn, Virginia, is so secure that Michael Jabara, the San Francisco-based global head of fraud services for the credit card network, has trouble getting through its double set of doors. With a Forbes reporter in tow, he scans his badge to get through the first door. A sensor beeps, but it doesn't unlock. Finally, with the help of the on-site security team, we get through both sets, the second requiring a fingerprint as well as an ID badge, and enter the Cyber Fusion Center, which sits at the heart of a secure 42-acre campus. Drive into this Visa complex without clearance from the security personnel manning the gate, and you can end up in a drainage pond, a modern-day protective moat. Inside the Fusion Center, analysts monitor a large screen displaying a variety of data reflecting how smoothly Visa's deluge of transactions, some $310 billion worth $15.9 trillion in 2024, are being processed worldwide, and where suspicious activity is high. A lot of the suspicious attacks are handled in an automated fashion, but there are certain incidents that generate human intervention, and then they get worked through a consistent playbook, Jabara explains. His ID badge now working, Jabara leads the way through yet another set of secure doors to the Situation Room, where a big screen displays more charts and lists, plus a news feed. In this room, employees are watching threats against Visa's clients, the 14,500 financial institutions in more than 200 countries, who are part of the world's largest credit card network. Jabara points to a chart that shows an ongoing brute force attack in which fraudsters are bombarding vendors with thousands of attempts to come up with an account number, expiration date, and three-digit CVV code that will work together. Our aim is to make sure that we're detecting large-scale attacks that could result in catastrophic losses or loss of consumer confidence, he says. Within the Situation Room area is another smaller conference room that contains yet another Visa unit. The workers in this one monitor the cybersecurity of Visa's own network operations. One of the things that we've really benefited from is having this close collaboration between cyber and fraud, because the threats are common, the actors are common, says Jabara. That's particularly true, he says, as fraud rings have become more sophisticated and nation-states more involved in fraud as well as cyber attacks. It's the late morning in Virginia, but as it turns tonight, this center will empty out, and Visa's security centers in London, Bangalore, and Singapore will handle more of the activity. In all, Visa now has more than 1,000 employees worldwide dedicated to risk and security, and says it has invested $11 billion in anti-fraud technology in the last 5 years. At the same time, it's been building a side business, selling the fraud-fighting expertise it's had to develop, some $1.5 billion of Visa's $35.9 billion in 2024 revenue came from its sales of risk and security services. Both fraud and fighting fraud are big businesses, with artificial intelligence increasingly driven on both sides. During Cyber Monday last November, Visa reported an 85% year-over-year increase in fraud attempts and a stunning 200% increase for the first official weekend of holiday shopping, increases it attributes in large part to AI. That word attempts is key, since most are thwarted, points out Steve Yin, global head of fraud at TransUnion. The big credit bureau got 7% of its $4.4 billion in 2024 revenue selling fraud prevention software. TransUnion estimates that 5.2% of all attempted digital transactions in the first half of 2024 involved suspected fraud, with the vast majority of those blocked. Still, the cost of successful fraud is growing, albeit at a much slower pace than attempts. Juniper Research estimates that e-commerce fraudsters worldwide grabbed $44 billion in 2024 and will siphon off $107 billion by 2029 for a 19.5% compound annual growth rate. It is a constant arms race, observes Nick Maynard, vice president of FinTech Market Research for Juniper. On the fraudster side, AI helps them launch more and more sophisticated attacks in a variety of ways. Among other things, they can impersonate people through deep fakes, launch mass attacks to find vulnerabilities in systems, use bots to navigate websites and extract information, and generate more believable emails that lead people to give up sensitive information. The protectors are equally dependent on AI. Visa now uses 115 different cybersecurity tools that collect and analyze intelligence from more than 300 resources, reports Visa Chief Information Security Officer Subrakumaraswamy. The company has built some of these tools, including a behavior analytics platform and its threat intelligence fusion platform. It also works with cybersecurity tool vendors, including Microsoft, Thales, IBM, Zscaler, Cloudflare, Checkpoint, and Palo Alto Networks. Because companies use so many different anti-fraud tools simultaneously, and because there are always new variants to fight, the anti-fraud business is also fertile ground for fintech startups. It's notable that five companies on the Ford 2025 Fintech 50 list, Alloy, Datavisor, Persona, Sentilink, and Zip help businesses prevent financial fraud, with each having its own specialty. Datavisor, for example, uses what's known as unsupervised machine learning to find correlations in seemingly unrelated events that could represent previously undiscovered fraud rings or methods. Sentilink, which first made its mark fighting synthetic identity fraud, where scammers combine real social security numbers and fake names, recently developed a tool to catch assumed identity abuse, a new variant where fraudsters exploit real identities for people who entered the U.S. on temporary visas and have left since. Synthetic and other fake identities are used, among other things, to acquire credit cards, take out car and personal loans, and open bank accounts used in fraudulent schemes. Visa isn't the only big credit card network treating fraud as not only a threat, but a business opportunity. In December, MasterCard, the number two network, finalized the $2.65 billion acquisition of Recorded Future, an AI-heavy cybersecurity company with 1,900 clients in 50 countries and $300 million in annual revenues. Last year, before that deal was announced, MasterCard launched a service with Recorded Future that aims to alert banks more quickly when a credit card is likely to have been compromised. The partnership, it says, has doubled the number of potentially compromised cards identified. MasterCard doesn't disclose how much of its $28 billion in 2024 revenues came from selling security services. Within its own network, MasterCard has been using AI to stop fraud for more than a decade, noticed Ranjita Iyer, Executive Vice President, Services North America. Like Visa, it monitors transactions across its entire network, using AI to detect suspicious activity. Recently, she says, it started using generative AI to predict what an individual's merchant business at a certain time should look like. That allows it to alert merchants if actual patterns diverge from what's projected, a possible warning flag of fraud. Last year, MasterCard also began selling banks an upgraded Decision Intelligence Pro system that uses AI to analyze and produce a risk score for each individual transaction in real time, less than 50 milliseconds, based on the purchase, the merchant, the cardholder, and other factors. The pitch is that it will not only detect more fraud, but produce fewer false positives, so fewer legitimate transactions will be blocked. For all the AI-based systems fighting fraud, human behavior still plays a key role in enabling and stopping scams. If you're securing the data, if you're securing the infrastructure, what's the weakest link? It's the consumer, says Visa's Jabara. There's no patch that we can send out to consumers to make them be more security conscious. That's why you've seen this massive proliferation of social engineering attacks, phishing scams, phishing, all of that. In a TransUnion survey of adults in 18 countries, 49% said they were targeted by email, online, phone call, or text messages during the second quarter of 2024. One phishing scheme on the rise, fake cancellation messages, meaning texts or emails telling users that something they've bought or booked will be canceled unless they log in using an included link. Of course, if they do, their login credentials are stolen. Earlier this month, when Visa announced a new scam disruption practice, a team that includes former law enforcement professionals as well as AI developers and data visualization experts, Jabara offered an intriguing example of the sort of scam that the team is targeting. Fraudsters were sending a phishing link from a dating website that looked like it was an identity verification page. But those who clicked were involuntarily enrolled in a monthly billing plan they never meant to sign up for. The team used the data from cracking that scheme to look for others operating in a similarly deceptive fashion and turned up 12,000 merchants engaged in the ploy. The rapid spread of that variant is evidence of another vexing development, fraud as a service, just like companies like Visa and MasterCard are selling their anti-fraud expertise to others. So too are fraudsters selling their new schemes to other fraudsters. These are very smart individuals, and they're very creative individuals, Yin observes. It's an ongoing battle, says Yin, who expresses faith in the ability of the fraud deterrence industry to come up with approaches to keep bad guys in check. One area TransUnion is now working with on clients is introducing more friction to today's instant transaction, extra steps that won't annoy a legitimate customer so much as scare them off, but can deter fraudsters. Consumers, he says optimistically, will embrace friction if they have a belief and an understanding that it's actually helping them reduce the likelihood that they're going to be a victim of fraud. That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much for listening. See you next Monday at 11 a.m. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein.